Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Okay, first one on the list today in the X directory is list resources, or listres, L-I-S-T-R-E-S. It looks like listres. Obviously, it should be pronounced listres because it's list resources. Whatever. It's a command. It lists resources of the XFT, is it XFT or XT? I don't know, whatever the X widget set is. It lists all of those. So it's an introspection command. It lets you see into the things that are running and or that are available on your system. And it kind of delineates the hierarchy, really, of various widgets, like of a label widget might be available as a child of the object rectangle core simple class, I guess. I mean, that whole thing isn't a class, but that's how that resource, that's the tree of that resource. So if you wanted to target a specific label for whatever reason, maybe you're using edit res to change the look and feel of your application, now you know where you could find that, you know, all of your labels, you would know where to look. So there are a couple of different, it's not a super complex command. You can just type in list res, and that lists literally all of them, all of the resources. But if you need something a little bit more targeted, you can do a list res dash top, which and then tell what class you want to treat as the top of the hierarchy. I didn't have great luck with that, or at least I didn't. I can't say that I got what I had expected. I do list... Actually, yeah, let me try this. List res dash top, and then I'll do rect. Oh, and then I'm going to pipe it to WC dash L to get a count. So that's 42. So then if I say top is core, which is underneath rect, and pipe that out to WC dash L, I still get 42. So I'm not really sensing that I'm getting anything noticeably different by changing this. And then if I go back to the top, which is object, I still get 42 results. So maybe it's just that I don't have enough going on my system or something. Not 100% sure what's going on there. You can also do a list res dash tree to see the results in a visually hierarchical way, but also, I mean, it'll deliver the information differently as well. It doesn't give you one resource per line. It gives you the resources available as they fall within the resource tree, which does mean that you don't get the sort of the benefit, as it were, of the alphabetical output of just list res. That just gives you everything alphabetically, so maybe that's easier to find. But the hierarchical view, or the tree view, gives you everything as it occurs within the classes and superclasses and things like that. So you've got object, rect, core, composite, box, constraint, form, dialogue, viewport, paned, tree, porthole, and shell, which shell is part of WM shell. So in the alphabetical list, you just get WM shell way down at the bottom, whereas shell here obviously falls at what was that, like 10 items or something. So completely different view of the same information, but the context in the tree view is how it all falls within sort of inheritance, whereas the alphabetical list obviously is just the resources that are available. I mean, that's list res. I don't know how useful it really is in 2024. Don't know how many people are still using this particular widget set. What is it called anyway? The X libxt. So it must be the XT. forget what XFT is, but anyway, oh, XFont. No, that's something else. Anyway, XT, libXT, that's the widget set, list res will give you a list of the resources within that widget set. Okay, next up is Lindir, L-N-D-I-R. So this is a symbolic linking tool. So it makes what the man page calls a shadow copy, which I'd never heard this term before. Maybe it's a common one, but it makes a shadow copy of, let's call it, Tudr. That's actually, I'm not calling it that. They're calling it that. I don't love that term, but they're calling it Tudr of a directory tree from Dir. So in other words, with linking, I really do think there is a serious problem with conceptualizing the source and the target, because in one context you can think of, or from one angle you can think of, well, if I want to make a symlink of foo, then the source is foo and the target entity that I am creating will be, I don't know, bar. So bar would be the link to foo. But wait a minute, that means that bar is the source and the target is foo, yeah? But I just said that foo was the source and bar was the target. So it's really, I think linking is really confusing for terminology, and it's too bad because it really, really is confusing. So anyway, Lindir, it makes a shadow copy, and I'll talk about what this means in a moment. Tudr of a directory tree from Dir, except that the shadow, that's this shadow copy, the shadow is not populated with real files, and instead is populated by lots of little symbolic links pointing to the real files in the from Dir directory. Okay, so now that maybe makes sense. In other words, let's say that I have a directory. I can't use their stupid Tudr and from Dir. I mean, not stupid, it's fine, but I'm not going to use it. Let's say I've got a directory called foo, and in foo, there are three files, 1, 2, and 3. I want to make a symbolic, I guess what we'll call it, a shadow copy. I like this term, shadow copy of foo, meaning I don't want just a portal to foo. I want a portal containing symlinks of the items in foo. I don't exactly know why you would want this, but I'm sure there are really good reasons. With Lindir, you can do that. You can just tell Lindir to create a symbolic copy of a directory. So I'm going to try it right now. I'm going to do a make dir of foo, and then I'm going to touch, well, actually, you know what? I'll echo hello one into foo1.txt. I'll do hello2 into foo.2.txt, and then hello3 into foo/3.txt. And now I'm going to do the Lindir, what's the fromdir and then todir. So foo is the from, no wait, see, this is why I get confused. Okay, so fromdir is going to be the from Dir, so it makes a shadow copy of Tudr. Okay, so that's the second argument. The second parameter is the thing that I want to create. So from is foo. So Lindir space foo space bar. And sadly, it says no such file or directory as something called bar. So that did not work, meaning I must have not understood the instructions. So how about Lindir bar foo? Still nothing existing in bar. Okay, so bar must have to exist, interestingly. So make dir bar. Now Lindir foo space bar. No such file as bar. Well, that's not correct. Foo, no such file or directory. Yeah, that's completely wrong. Okay, how about Lindir bar foo, no such file or directory as bar. Okay, so obviously something's wrong here. So I'm going to now do a Lindir. I mean, spoiler alert, I know how to get this to work, but it does not work as expected. So I'm pretending for the sake of drama, I guess. But also just, this is the interesting thing about discovering so many new commands and libraries and things like that, because you get to see how documentation may or may not accurately reflect the actual use case or just the use of a command. You get to see how man pages sometimes maybe express things in confusing ways, and so on. So this is I find this sort of thing kind of interesting. Okay, so I'm going to do a file on foo and just confirm that, yes, foo does exist. It is a directory that exists. I'm going to do, again, linder foo space bar. And again, foo, no such file or directory. All right, so linder, the way it actually works, for whatever reason, I don't know why, because the man page clearly does not state this. The man page clearly says linder, and then it gives three different parameters that are options that you're allowed to use, dash silent, dash ignore links, dash with rev info. I'm not using any of those. Those are optional. And then from dir, and then in brackets, to dir. So the brackets mean that that is optional, but I do have the bar directory. It does exist. I'll do a file bar. Yep, it's a directory. Okay, so that exists. So I should be able to do linder foo bar, but it doesn't work. So if I just do linder foo, then do an ls in my current directory, then I discover that, as it turns out, yeah, there's 1.txt, 2.txt, and 3.txt in my current directory. So I'm going to get rid of the txt files. I'm going to change into the bar directory, and then I'm going to do linder dot dot slash foo, then do an ls, and there's my nice and tidy little symlinks in my current directory, which is now bar. So that's the intended target. So why it's not respecting the second parameter, I cannot say. I don't know. I don't understand why. According to the man page, that's an optional second parameter. So that seems like it should be the destination, and yet that's not how it works. So I don't know. I don't know what to say. That doesn't work quite as well as intended. So now you've got this directory full of symlinks, sort of mirroring another directory. And that's kind of intriguing. The concept does intrigue me. There are some weaknesses to this, aside from the fact that the man page incorrectly tells you how to use the command. There are some, or maybe it's not incorrect, but it's certainly misleading, because I cannot find any case in which the to dir at the end of the command is respected. I don't know what use case there is for that. I think that might be an error in the man page. Anyway, The use case of this is kind of intriguing to me, because I do actually use something vaguely similar to this conceptually. I don't use linder, but I mean, I do use a system called Git Portal that I wrote, and it is an add-on to Git whereby you can designate a directory as a quote-unquote portal, just meaning an extra dimensional space where you can stash real files and then use just the symlinks to those real files in your Git repository. This is useful when you have very large files that you don't want to version control, but you want to incorporate into your repository. Now, it does require that your contributors have access to this directory, wherever you keep it, of large files, but it also keeps your Git history clean of the actual binary data involved. So it's a little bit of a Git LFS or a Git Annex, that kind of system. It's just a little bit different. And it does use this, you know, it goes in and looks at directories and sees what the contents are, and it makes symlinks and sends it over there to the directory and so on. So, I mean, it is a thing that kind of plays around with symlinks and how useful they can be. And in my version, you can remove a file from your Git repository, and then the symlink gets removed as well, which is nice. Linder, interestingly, does not have that functionality. And in fact, there is a little bit of a warning here in the man page, although it's not treated as a warning, it's just kind of an aside, just says deleting files is a more painful problem. The symlinks will just point into never land. So it's telling you that yes, you can use linder. You can even add files and then run linder again to add those, to get those added files, you know, copied over into your shadow copy. However, if you are removing files from your source, you know, your origin point, then Linder will never knows to remove those files. So that's just sort of something to be aware of with Linder. So I want to like Linder, but in practice, I think it might be a little bit too primitive. I think if I was, I don't know, again, I don't know exactly the use case for this. It seems useful. And I mean, certainly it is, the concept is useful because I use it with Git Portal all the time, but I don't know that this implementation is the way that I would do this with. In fact, I would probably script something myself in favor of, you know, rather than using Linder. I would probably just use like a combination of a normal symlink, ln, and maybe, I don't know, like the find command to, you know, if I remove a file, then maybe run this script to go and find, you know, and or but maybe it would be rsync, something like rsync, to sync up the files. The shadow copy and the folder back in so that they actually align. Not too sold on Linder after having tried to put it to use. But it is an interesting, I think the concept is super interesting, and I think it's worth paying attention to, because that kind of symlinks, I think they can be, well, I think they're super useful, honestly. I use symlinks, I think, a lot more than I maybe even realize. Like, I use them a lot, because every time I need, like, a reference file in one project and in another project, I can just link. I don't have to have the same file in two places. I mean, it's the obvious use case for symlinks, I guess. And I guess when I first very, very, very early on got introduced to the ideas of symlinks, I just kind of thought, well, okay, so those are the links that you put, those are the shortcuts you put on your desktop, right? That's the symlink. That's all those are good for. And it's actually, actually it can be really useful for information management to really just make sure that you're always pointing back to a single source of truth. Very, very useful. All right, so, but you have to kind of make sure that you're managing them carefully, because I mean, symlinks can get broken, symlinks can start to get cluttered up if you're putting them all over the place and you're not really cleaning up when you don't need them anymore or whatever the scenario. You do have to be a little bit careful with symlinks, and you have to remember that there are symlinks, you know, like, I mean, I know in my head, like, that a lot of my sort of the way that I organize my projects, a lot of them will have symlinks. So if I'm copying it to one place from one place to another, I know that I probably need to make sure that I'm copying the file and not the symlink, which, I mean, rsync and probably copy, but I mean, rsync has options, you know, to actually go fetch the actual file, not the symlink, not the link itself, rather. Okay, next one is Luit, L-U-I-T. This is a character encoding converter for X terms, basically, or X11 terminals. This is a little application which typically you won't run yourself. This is something that Xterm calls silently in the background to convert output to a specific locale, or rather from a specific locale's encoding to UTF-8. This accounts for, you know, sort of those theoretical terminals in my life, I say theoretical terminals that don't do UTF-8. I don't know how frequent that is, honestly, at least not in my own life. It may happen on legacy systems. It may happen, you know, more often than I realize elsewhere. So I'm not sure, but this is kind of it's a conversion application. Like I say, you're not going to actually call it yourself, probably. Xterm just calls it in the background. But if you need to call it yourself, you can do like xterm-u8-eluit. And then that launches a new Xterm session, piping input or I guess standard, what would it be? Standard out, I guess, through Luit or something. Yeah, I guess that's what it would be, standard out through Luit. You could do something even cleverer if you're doing, like, if you're interacting with a remote machine without that does not have UTF-8 support. You can adapt the remote computer's output to your own terminal. So LC_all=FR_FR. Let's say you're on a French computer and you need to, you're remoting over to something that does not support UTF-8. So you could do LC_all=FR_FR luit space SSH space your remote machine. Now you've got a session of, you've got a secure, you're opening your secure shell on that remote, but everything's getting processed through LUIT before you see it. There are a couple of other use cases, but like I say, I just, in my life, I don't see this problem. So it's really difficult for me to sort of see the urgency behind LUIT. I mean, I can imagine it would be very useful when running into something that doesn't support like modern encoding, essentially. But I don't interact with those computers myself, wherever they may be. Still good to know about, though, right? I mean, you kind of want to know that a solution does exist. So if it ever happens to you, just remember episode 586, LUIT, LUIT. Okay, next up is m17in-lib. This, I think, differentiates it from m17in database, I believe, is why it's called considered a dash lib. It's an implementation of multilingualization for applications that you're writing in C. So m17n, that's m as in Mike, and then 17 letters, and then n as in November. M17N, multilingualization. This is, it's a library that you're going to use in your C code to unlock the potential of translatable text. There is apparently, in the world of software development, a subtle difference between internationalization, localization, and multilingualization. And then in some sources, I've also seen sort of this other one called globalization. While I think there are subtleties to each thing, I think each one implies something a little bit different. But generally, the goal is to get your application so that it reflects your target audiences, the linguistic expectations, really, whether that means the character set that's being used, because maybe it's a completely different alphabet, whether it means terminology or spelling, because certain words might mean different things to your audience based on their region, or a combination of both, quite likely a combination of both. Whatever it is, you as a programmer, you probably don't know all of your target audience's needs, and so you can only kind of do what you can do, but you want to make it available, because it's open source, to other people so that they can go in and update localization things and make the settings that make sense for their local region. One of the most popular ways to do this is with Git text and through sort of XML lists of what each resource has assigned to it, like what kind of what letters, what words are assigned to this label, to that label, to that button, to that menu selection, and so on. You create a master list of the terms that you had in mind, and then other people can go in and create a version of that, you know, versions of those resources in their language. That's one of the things M17N allows you to do. It pulls in libxml2, or not pulls in, but it uses libxml2, it uses Git text, I think. It uses all these different libraries to ensure that you have separated content from function so that other people can add the content that makes sense for their region. And so that packagers can package up the application using the correct localization option for their specific audience. There's that aspect of compiling it with those, you know, with knowledge of the translations. And for what it's worth, I would say that there's in the source code of M17N, there's a file called, what is it called? About NLS. And that file, you can find this file in, here it is. You can find that file in user doc m17in-lib/db. Oh, okay, so interesting. The DB must be included here. I didn't see the DB files here. I figured maybe that was in a different package. Maybe the database is just, maybe Yeah, the database must be in files that I don't recognize as database sort of components, because I thought that the database was, no, there it is, mdb.dir. I'll bet that's, yeah, okay. So I think the stuff in user share m17n is the database. Okay, cool. I stand corrected. The database does appear to be here with the lib. Oh, it says right there, this package also contains the m17n database. Okay, thank you for spelling it out for me. Too bad I didn't read. So there you go. That's m17n. You can read the about NLS, which is the Free Translation Project. I'm not kidding. NLS apparently stands for Free Translation Project. I'm assuming it's either an initialism in another language, or it's an initialism that doesn't directly correlate to what it's welcoming me to. It says notes on the Free Translation Project. That's what the that's what this file says about -NLS, and it is a pretty darned useful. Like, if I wouldn't say it was a great sort of getting started for with GitText and with M17N by any means, because it does kind of assume that you're here, because I think arguably I think they kind of assume that you know what you're doing, I would say. And I mean, certainly it assumes that you know that you're compiling software, for instance, with this. So it's not absolute beginner, but I think it does offer a lot of good sort of explanation about the different components involved, what kind of different things you need to look for when you're compiling, how to configure it when you're compiling, .configure --with --included --git text, for instance. That's a really important thing to know. The irony is not lost on me that in a file called about NLS, there is no definition provided of NLS, but other than that, it's a pretty darned useful little file just to kind of get a small view of the bigger picture, which is a weird way to say it, but I do think that's what it is. It's like, if you've already done a little research into this and you just want to see more sort of more talk about the same subject, this is a good file to read. If you're completely new to the concept of internationalization or multilingualization, I guess in this case, this is probably not the file to start with, but it is an informative file if you're kind of already in that region, in that neighborhood, in that ballpark. All right, next up is make depend. This create dependencies in make files. This is a cool one. I thought we've already talked about this, to be honest, so I'm a little surprised to find it here, but maybe I was just playing around with it and forgot that we hadn't talked about it yet. Or possibly there's another app. I think there's another application a little bit like this. Either way, this one's make depend, I guess, from BSD, actually, apparently. Is that right? No, MIT. From MIT, Project Athena specifically. But I guess it first appeared in the fourth Berkeley distribution. Anyway, make depend 1.06 is what we're at. And this is a make file parser that reads a source file, which is normally a make file, and looks for and looks at the files that the make file calls, and looks for hash include, hash define, hash undef, hash if def, if indef, end if elif, and else directives, so that it can figure out what libraries may be used under any condition by that make file, and then it records those, all of those items in the make file itself, such that when something changes, your make file knows to recompile important object files. So this is very frequently used in a make file as the make space depend instruction. People can put just make depend --$ parentheses C flags close parentheses --$ parentheses SRCS close parentheses, for instance, that where sources are, you know, your source code file.c, file2.c, file3.c, your C flags are whatever you would pass to your CC, your GCC, like -i/user /include /my special directory, and your optimization flags and things like that. I think that's the expectation of the author of how it's going to be used. You can run it manually on a make file that's just referencing, some code, and it will, as the man page states, it will go through the code, find all the include statements, whether they're just at the top of the file where include statements very frequently are, or whether they're sort of buried within some kind of conditional. It finds them, it goes and fetches that. It basically pretends like it's compiling your code, and it finds everything that a compile action would require, and it makes sure that the makefile is aware that that file is required, is a dependency of your little local code files. It seems really useful. I'm going to admit I've never used it. I've never had anything really that involved in terms of like C and C++. So it does seem nice. I'm kind of used to either like Python stuff where you just list your requirements in a file and let pip deal with it, or Java stuff where you list your requirements in a file and let Gradle or Maven deal with it, that kind of thing. I quite like those systems. I think they're perfectly serviceable. But C obviously doesn't have that. C++ I don't think has anything like that, not that I'm aware of. So this is not a bad option, it feels like to me. Like if I was going to do a really, really big C or C++ project, then I could see myself really, really liking this style of utility. Speaking of liking things, I'm going to go have some coffee, which I quite like. You should go get some coffee. We'll come back, do 5 or 6 more packages. See you then. I'm back with coffee. I'm having the last bit of my winter coffee. It's springtime here in New Zealand as I record this, but only just. Like 2 days ago, I had the fire on again because it was that cold. So still kind of that uncertain time where sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's hot. You never know what you're going to get in spring, but this coffee is good. It's hot. I guess it's wintry. It's branded as a winter blend. I don't know what I'm going to have after this. It's very exciting. I'm weighing all of my options. Don't know which direction I'm going to go in. As I've said, this blend here that I've got right now, Memphis, mixed with a little bit of Big Cozy. Memphis was dark, a very dark roast, and it was really kind of giving me the shakes after I had a whole pot of it over the course of a day, because that's just a lot of caffeine. So I have cut it a little bit with Big Cozy so that I can continue to drink coffee throughout the day without like really over caffeinating myself. That's the goal here. So I have cut it with Big Cozy, and it's a great little blend. It's the more I have coffee in my place of dwelling, the more I realize that I'm a blender. I blend coffees. It's not a scientific process. It is just if I've got two different bags of two different kinds of coffees, either at the end of those bags or at the beginning, depending on what I have to do to just maintain a constant supply of hot beverage, those bags are going to be mixed together at some point. Sorry, coffee manufacturers, if you've very carefully put coffee and roasted it very nicely and put it to bags and sold it, it's all for naught. I'm just going to put it into one big coffee pot and brew it. And it's good. It just kind of works, which is a testament to how good coffee really is. You can just do whatever you want to with it, and it will still taste a treat. Okay, so the package that we're on to now is Marisa, M-A-R-I-S-A. It is an acronym for the matching algorithm with recursively implemented storage, Marisa. It is a static, space-efficient tri-data structure. Tri also sometimes, I guess, historically pronounced tree, but that is rather confusing because tree sounds like tree, so they're pronouncing it try, because there's no other word that sounds like try. T-R-I-E. Of course, in English, I'm being sarcastic, in English it's T-R-Y. Try is a very common word. So try and tree are both kind of confusing. You will also hear these called, I think, prefix trees or digital trees, according to Wikipedia, I think. So I guess maybe they are trying to get away from just the vague try, tree. Either way, whatever you call it, Marisa is an implementation of this concept of a digital tree or a prefix tree or a try. And the concept here is that you have a root node at the top of your little cascading diagram. And from, and you'll, you, this will sound vaguely familiar to you if you've, if you used like XPath or anything like that, where it's an inverted sort of, well, where it's a cascading group of nodes. What am I talking about? The Linux file system too. This might sound familiar to you if you use the Linux file system to a degree. So you have this root node at the top, and then under the root node, the root node has children. And in this case, we'll say, let's say that it has two children, an H and a W. Okay, so the H, it's got a child. And that's an E, and it's got a child, which is an L, and that has a child, which is an L, and that has a child, which is an O. This is not the most efficient version of this example, because, or of this principle, because we could have combined the L or something like that, but we're just doing a really simple one. So H-E-L-L-O in one path. And then the other path, which started at the W, that has a child of O, that has a child of an R, and then L, and then D. So you have this structure that starts with root, and then H, and then W, and then E, and then O, and then L, and then R, and L, and L, and then O, and D. I think I spelled everything correctly there. And that's your diagram. And the cool thing about this is that it's easy to retrieve data from this diagram. Because you can ask your interface, your computer interface, whatever it might be. In this case, it would be, of course, Marisa, or rather you would be interfacing with Marisa through C++ to query for something that might be in your digital tree, in your try diagram. And so you could, for instance, ask, is the word hello in the diagram? And Marisa would immediately start at root, descend to the children, and it's H or W. Well, hello starts with an H, so I guess the only logical path is to go down the H path. And then does the E follow the H? Yes, it does. L, yeah, okay, so yes, we have hello. Yes, confirmed. So the searchability of such a diagram is quite fast because the search path is really easy to determine. You can set that path pretty quickly, pretty early, ideally, and then the computer has found your data. So it's a really nice structure for storing certain kinds of data, and then more importantly, retrieving that kind of data, which is actually where the word, the phrase, or the name try, T-R-I-E, comes from. It's short. It's like the middle part of retrieval or something like that. So this is all about retrieval. Now, in addition to having a bunch of C++ libraries, I think also a Python library might be included in this, or it might be something new. I'm not sure. I don't remember. Let's look really quick. Let's do less of var log packages / Marisa. Actually, you know what? Let's not do a less. Let's do a grep for just py. Yeah, it looks like there's a Python interface, but this is only for 2.7. That's why I guess I didn't register that it existed. But so it's got the C++ and the Python libraries, so you can use Marisa in your programming. It's also got a really interesting terminal application here that you can use to build a Marisa database or whatever they call it, a diagram or a try tree. So there's a couple of, if you type in Marisa dash and then tab a bunch of times, you'll find, oh wait, that's interesting. Oh, here we go. Yeah. Marisa dash and then tab a bunch of times. You come up with about 7 different commands. Marisa benchmark, Marisa build, Marisa common prefix search, Marisa dump, Marisa lookup, Marisa predictive search, Marisa reverse lookup. So Marisa build is the command that you use to build a little database for yourself. Now, you don't start with Marisa build though first. You start with, or I mean, this is one way of doing it. There's a couple of different ways of doing it. I'm doing a really simple example. So I'm going to open up in Emacs something called mywords.txt. And I'm going to type some words, tails, T-A-L-E-S, tails, T-A-I-L-S, talisman, T-A-L-I-S-M-A-N. So those all start with T-A and potentially L, potentially I, but in different order, and then an S in there. So there's similarities. And then world, and then how about worldly, and then we'll do worthy. So that's W-O-R, and then some branch. And then absent, absolute, and abeyance, A-B-E-Y-A-N-C-E. That's 9 words. Not that complex, but you know, it's kind of we've given a little bit of diversity there. Now we can use Marisa dash build space dash dash text dash tail. That's just to use. That's to build. There's no man page for this, but if you do a dash H, Marisa dash build dash H, space dash H, you can see the options. And so there's a binary tail or a text tail. The text tail is the default, so you don't really have to specify it, but I did. So Marisa-build dash dash text dash tail dash O Marisa.db. I don't know what extension to use actually, but it feels like a database-ish kind of thing. I guess you could do like dot, I don't know, LUT. Well, it's not really an LUT, but anyway, whatever. It's a thing, right? And it's going to be a binary file. So then mywords.txt, which is my little 9-word list. Hit return, and it tells me that I've got keys 9 and nodes 15. So now I can use Marisa-predictive-search and then give it the file that I want to use as the basis for this search, Marisa.db in this case. And it looks like it's kind of like it steals your prompt. You're now in the predictive search. So I'm going to type WORLD. Return, and it says two found, world and worldly. Okay, cool. I can keep typing because I'm still within the predictive search. So now I'll do absol, A-B-S-O-L, one found, absolute. Okay, how about A-B? Three found, absent, absolute, and abeyance. And then let's do a T-A-I. One found is tails, T-A-I-L-S. And then T-A-L, two found, tails, talisman. So yeah, I'm searching my database, in other words. Or I shouldn't say database. I'm searching my try. So that is, those are two of the commands available from this package. There are a couple of other, you know, ways to interface with your try. You can do a Marisa dash dump and then your the name of your diagram, and then it literally just dumps all the keys, all everything that it's, you know, all of the little keys that it's find. And so it knows, for instance, like world and worldly, it distinguishes within the try through metadata. It knows that world is one word and worldly is another word. And that's why there are 9 keys, even though some of those keys are subsets of each other. So world and worldly, you might think, well, isn't that just one key really? Because I mean, it's worldly. But if you're searching for world, then yes, it has been found because it's a subset of worldly. But for the try, because not everything is really super basic dictionary word lookups, there is a termination character or data within the digital tree. That's really about it. I mean, there is Marisa lookup, which gives you kind of a different kind of way to look through your try. It'll tell you, like, if you type in a substring like WOR, it gives you a -1 for, I guess, for no, not found. But then if you give it the complete string like world, then it tells you that yes, it is found, and at what like node it has been found, or something like that. For instance, world, it says to world, and then absolute, for instance, is at 5, and what's another one? Talisman, let's look what that is. That's at 7. So I don't actually know what those numbers mean, but I'm assuming it's got to be like the node notation or something. And it doesn't tell me. It doesn't tell me. Like there are no you just control C to get out of these programs. There's no manual page for any of them. But anyway, it's a neat little terminal application, I guess, you know, for something if you just want to see it working. But I think more importantly, obviously, the library is probably what people generally are going to use, whether it's for C++ or Python in this case. But there are digital tree libraries other than Marisa as well. But as for Marisa, that's it. Next up is Mesa 3D. I've already covered this previously because we were talking about OpenGL stuff, but I just want to kind of reiterate Mesa is a big deal. Mesa 3D is a big deal. It's the open source implementation of OpenGL, of Vulkan, and all those things. It's the libraries that you're actually using on your Linux desktop. Started something like 31 years ago or something like that, something around that number, Brian Paul, the man with two first names, Brian Paul. And he presented about his, you know, sort of his history, like the history of Mesa 3D, at the x.org conference back in 2013. And that recording is on YouTube. So I highly recommend it. I will put the link in the show notes because it's just him up on a stage at a conference talking just all about the history of how Mesa got started. And it is a fascinating talk if you're interested in this sort of thing, because he's talking about like how in the early days of, I mean, early days of everything, you know, well, not everything, but the early days of like 3D graphics, the early days of sort of, I guess, desktop Unix in a way. I mean, yeah, I'm going to say that. I mean, you know, the time where people were discovering that, oh, these Unix workstations are actually really, really useful for graphic work. But back in those early days, like you had SGI and all of these other vendors who, SGI is the only one I know, but I mean, lots of them, they were all out there. And they each had their own way of talking to the processor that was going to create the graphics. And so if you were writing an application that needed to generate graphics, you might have like three or four different, you'd have to program your application to make calls to three or four or some number of different APIs to do graphics. And I mean, that you might think, okay, well, that's kind of that's problematic, but I mean, you could do it. You know, you just do an if else statement at the top where you establish what API you are using on that thing, or you do that at compile time, whatever, and then you just figure it out. Well, yeah, sure, that sounds great until you realize that sometimes you might want to make a API call that there's just no equivalent of on that other hardware, you know, then what do you do? So, and you know, you could program around it, but I mean, the point is that you're doing a lot of programming around things here. So eventually Brian Paul just started this project, the Mesa 3D project, and it has grown and grown and grown and become a major sort of force of graphics on open source, in open source projects. So you're using Mesa 3D, you're appreciating it, and it's got a fascinating backstory. That's all I think I have to say about that, given how much else I've said about OpenGL in past episodes. Okay, make Compose cache. It creates a global system-wide Compose cache file. So this is the thing that generates a cache, obviously a cache file for your compose key on your keyboard, or rather for the things that your compose key could generate on your keyboard. I've talked about this in past episodes, how to set this sort of thing up, but very briefly, if you're using Linux, There is a secret, there's a key on your keyboard that may or may not be enabled that can unlock secret hereforetofunknown characters on your keyboard. So, for instance, if I am, let's do Kate maybe. Yeah, I'll do Kate. So if I've got Kate open and I'm typing the word, I don't know, cafe. There should be a little fancy little thing over the E on cafe, right? An accent mark. Okay, well, how do you get that? Well, on Linux, you can press, I'll type C-A-F, and then I'll stop. And then I'll press my compose key, which we'll talk about what that is in a moment. And then I'll press apostrophe, and then the E. And after I hit apostrophe, nothing happens. It looks like the computer ate the key press. But actually what it's done is it's stored that apostrophe as kind of an accent mark for whatever letter you give it next. So there's cafe now on my screen with an E with an with an accent mark over it because I did the fancy compose combination. I can do an apostrophe facing the other direction, which wouldn't be in cafe, but what word would have that? Resume has the... I can't think of a word. Well, okay. Fête. That's not a fête wouldn't have the apostrophe going the other way. So, but it would F and then compose key, and then I'll press the shift 6 for a little caret, and then E, and now I have E with a caret over it, and then I can continue typing T E. You can do compose colon parentheses, and you get a little smiley face, and so on. There's a bunch of combinations, and the combinations, like what you get when you press a certain combination of letter, or I say combinations, I should say a sequence of letters, because you're not pressing them at the same time. You're pressing the compose key, and then you're removing your hand from the keyboard, and then you're pressing the apostrophe or whatever, and then you remove your hand from the keyboard, and then you press the E or the O or the A or whatever you want to do next, and then you're taking your hand away from the keyboard. So it is a sequence of key presses, and the key presses that render, you know, what those key presses render depends on your locale and what compose file you are using. And you can see those in, I think, user share x11 locale, and then your locale, and then the file name is compose with a capital C. And this gives you a very long list of all the possible key combinations you could possibly want to render, given the correct font as well. You would need a character encoding that can display all of these characters. But there they are. I mean, this is a very, very long file. Let me do a WC-L on this file. 633 different combinations. So there's a lot in there. And it's really, really handy. Like, I use bullet points all the time. Well, I use the option to do a bullet point with the compose key frequently. So I do the compose key, and then the dot, and then the equal sign. And that gives you a bullet point. Or a dot, or rather compose dot dash also gives you a little bullet point. And let's see what else. There's compose OC for a copyright symbol, if you need that. Yeah, there's a bunch of them. I mean, like I say, look in your compose file. Now, what a compose cache is, I have no clue. I don't know. Is the compose file the cache? I don't know. But make compose cache looks at your compose file for your locale, and then generates a cache file, which it places in /var/cache/libx11/compose. I don't know exactly. Let me look at that file really quick. I'm going to do a file of var cache libx11. No, I do not have that file. I don't have that file, so I don't exactly know why you really need the cache file. I mean, cache is generally meant to do, for expediency. So I'm assuming it's got something to do with that. But apparently, I've been living my life without a composed cache. So I guess it's okay. And the man page doesn't explain why I need a cache file for this. But it does seem like maybe it's for probably expediency. It says, if internal name has been specified, it is used as the name of the composed table for computing the hash values and internal validation. So, it you know, hash to me says, yeah, quicker lookup. I'm thinking it's got to be for speed. But I mean, I've lived my entire life without having, apparently, a composed cache. So I don't know the purpose of this command. And as I said, man page doesn't make it super clear or clear at all, actually. It just doesn't even address that at all. Let's talk about make font scale. Make font scale creates the fonts.scale and the fonts.dir index files used by legacy X11 font systems. So this is an old way that the X windowing system was able to figure out how to render fonts. It is legacy. I'm not going to bother looking into it. Sorry, just don't care. Motif. This is the industry standard user interface toolkit for the X window system. That is a bold statement. I don't know what that means exactly, but that apparently Motif, M-O-T-I-F, is, I guess it's the industry standard windowing system, or, you know, a toolkit for the windowing systems. So apparently Motif is still a thing. Like, I kind of thought, okay, well, sure, this is old. No one's using this anymore. And yet, it is still a thing. It is on motif.ics.com, and it is a windowing, you know, it's a really basic windowing system for generally, I would imagine, it is probably used for low end computer systems that you do want the GUI on it, but you don't need all the bells and whistles of a modern GUI, like a whole desktop. That's what I'm assuming. I mean, because even like something like WX Widgets, which I think for bizarrely is the second episode in a row I've talked about WX Widgets. Even something like WX Widgets, which a lot of people think, oh, well, that's a great alternative to blah, blah, blah. Well, no, I mean, like it requires GTK. Like, it builds on GTK, or at least it did when I last used it. So if you really need something with a completely different footprint, and I'm assuming Motif must be quite small. I mean, that is one of its selling points, according motif.ics.com. One of the selling points is like its small footprint. So I'm thinking maybe places use it because it is lightweight. And sometimes all you need is like a window and some buttons on it. Maybe not even the window. Maybe you just need some buttons. And I don't know how easy it is to use. I do kind of wonder. But I mean, I think it's definitely crossed over into the, you know, sort of the legacy, the good kind of, I guess is legacy ever good? But I mean, the kind of the good, reliable kind of legacy. The thing that people, it's been around for so long that people probably can't imagine that it's going to ever go away. And so it's just a thing that people are using because it is there. It does exactly what it needs to do with minimal change over the years, probably. So that's kind of the feeling I get. Of course, I'm saying that just based on really just the ICS website. I don't actually know. I have no experience with Motif, really. I've compiled stuff, I think, that actually did use Motif, but I mean, you know, that this for fun or by accident. So I don't exactly know who's using Motif, but it exists. It's on your system. You could use it today. You could be using it right now for all I know. So it's there. It exists. It's a lightweight little tool, GUI toolkit for the X11 windowing system. And another feature of it is that it can actually be licensed in various different ways. The one on Slackware obviously is the GPL version, but you could also, you can buy a commercial license just in case you don't understand how GPL works, or you don't want to ever think about the GPL for whatever reason. You can just buy it outright, or whatever, you know, buy a license, I guess. And then you can do whatever you want with Motif within your little application. So it's a pretty flexible, or at least, you know, legally flexible toolkit as well. There's just two more to go in the M section. So let's just finish these off. They're two good ones, but I don't have a whole lot technically to say about them. So one is MT-DEV, which is a multi-touch device driver. It used to be that one finger on a touchpad was all you ever needed. But then people started expecting things like pinching motions or double feet, two-finger, three-finger, palm detection, all of these other... Actually, I don't know if palm detection actually... Well, I guess it probably does, because that would be part of an accidental, potentially, multi-touch. Either way, more than just one finger on a touchpad. You want to zoom and enhance. You want to pinch. You want to do two fingers or three fingers, swipe across, whatever. For this, you need a driver. You need something to detect multi-touch. I mean, obviously, some of that is on the hardware as well, probably, but the MT-DEV is the default go-to multi-touch driver for X. And then the next package, the last of the M's in this X directory, is MyPaint Brushes. This, I mean, talked about MyPaint library, I think, in the previous episode or the one before that. And this is These are the brushes themselves that the engine uses. So there's various components to brush emulation. One is the engine, which sort of dictates, it kind of sets up the, I don't want to say this, but I'm going to say it, the physics sort of the brush experience. So how much pressure is being applied? What happens when pressure is applied? Does it just get darker, or does the ink or the paint or whatever supposed to be on your device sort of splotch and spread out away from the point, or does it, and after you've drawn a line for so long, does it ever run out, or does it continue, and so on? So you've got a bunch of different things that you're, you know, that are potential. Like this is the world. This is what it is to be a brush like device, or a writing device, really, or a drawing device. And then you've got the brushes themselves. So these are the things that define which of these attributes this item has and in what quantity. So yes, this is a brush with bristles. This is a pen with a ballpoint. This is a pen with just a nub and some ink, a fountain pen. This is a pen with a felt tip. This is a piece of charcoal. This is a piece of chalk. This is a graphite pencil, and so on. All those different kinds of brushes, they need to have presets. They need to have certainly icons so that you can tell one from the other. They need to have the different characteristics of how their medium flows or doesn't flow or marks, whatever. So those are the brushes. That's them. MyPaint-Brushes. Those are all the brushes that MyPaint engine in GIMP uses. Or if you download MyPaint and start using MyPaint itself, you would, I guess, probably use these MyPaint brushes as well. Or I don't know actually who. I'm assuming that if you do that, yeah, it would detect this package and then it would use these brushes. I haven't really tested that exactly. But that's what this package is. It's a bunch of brushes for, in this case, GIMP MyPaint brush tool selection. That's it. It's all the packages. That's a couple of the L's, all of the M's. In the next time, we're going to do N as in November, and whatever's after that. I think it would be O. Yep, pretty much O. So yeah, N's and O's. No. Yes, next time. Talk to you then.